From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
Well, Democrats are gathering in Chicago, preparing for the national convention. It's a big affair. There is not much uncertainty about what will happen inside the United Center, but there are some concerns about protests that will take place outside. Also, we'll remember a longtime government watchdog. That's coming up here on State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield. Our panel includes Charlie Wheeler, professor emeritus and former director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Charlie's also been a longtime reporter and observer. Good to have him back after his vacation. And our guest this week is Dan Petrella. He's a political writer with the Chicago Tribune. Dan, good to have you on the show as well.
Good to be back.
So, Dan, Chicago hosting the convention once again, for those that don't know. It has hosted conventions more than political conventions more than any other city. It is where Lincoln became his party's nominee, for example. It's a big event. So is the city ready for this?
The city will tell you that they are. We will see. I think that will get tested starting on Monday when the real convention action gets going. But the security perimeters around the United Center and McCormick Place, where the convention action will take place, are going up. I was at the unveiling of the stage last night inside the United Center, where the speeches will be delivered. The balloons are being hoisted into the rafters, so they are ready to go.
So, Charlie, quite a turnaround for this convention. I mean, just a few weeks back before your vacation, people were looking at this as sort of a ho-hum event. Joe Biden was not getting a lot of enthusiasm from Democrats. Now Kamala Harris, the nominee, and seems as though enthusiasm is back. So this convention, if nothing else, should be something where you're going to see a lot of celebrating among the Democrats who attend.
Yeah, I think in terms of actually news happening or something that would be unexpected within the convention itself, either McCormick Place or at the United Center, I don't think there's going to be anything that people aren't expecting. The mood, as you suggested, is going to be a lot more joyous with Harris at the top of the ticket rather than Joe Biden. And the Democrats are going to be a lot more fired up about their chances, because the polling suggests that Harris is doing much better against Donald Trump than Biden was. But in terms of the actual breaking news, I suspect the real action is going to be outside the convention itself on the streets of the city, where there's any number of protests that are being planned, objecting to various pertinent issues, particularly the pro-Palestinian folks who are objecting to the United States providing money and arms to Israel for Israel to carry out what they see as genocide against the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip over in the Middle East. So that's what I think will be creating news, how the protesters are able to put forward their opinions and have their marches and their parades, and what the reaction of the Chicago Police Department is going to be. As a matter of fact, the latest brouhaha, and I don't think it's been settled as we're recording the show, is that a group of protesters wanted to begin their march at Union Park, which is a city park not that far away from the United Center, and they asked for the permit months ago, and it finally came on Wednesday, and it allowed for the rally, but the city said it's subject to the following conditions: no stages or platforms, no portable restrooms or toilets, no tents or canopies, no sound equipment may be installed by your organization. And so the protest leaders are saying, what the heck? What kind of a rally can we get going when we have none of these things that you would expect? So they're appealing that decision. And whether or not it's been resolved, as I say, as we are recording the show, I don't know. But that, in my mind, is just kind of a setup for what might occur, where these various protest groups, various organizations wanting to exercise their First Amendment rights are going to perhaps clash with the city's attempt to keep a lid on everything and avoid any kind of disturbance that might reflect poorly on the city.
Yeah, and it's a really, it's a tightrope walk for Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson, because he is not Richard Daley. He is not cozy with the Chicago Police Department by any means. He said several times when he's faced questions about this very issue over the last several months that, he has an affinity with the people who want to be out there demonstrating. He was out of the Chicago Teachers Union, the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. And so it's a little bit of an awkward situation for him to be in, to be the one whose administration is making decisions, limiting the ability of these protesters to have their voices heard. They've encouraged people to come and fully exercise their First Amendment rights, but then at the same time, they're saying you can have free speech, you just can't do it through a microphone. So that is definitely a point of tension to watch as we go into the convention next week. And I think just one thing that I'm uncertain of, that I think we're all kind of waiting to see, is just how many people show up for these various protests and demonstrations.
Yeah, Dan, you can't have a convention in Chicago without thinking of the 1968 Democratic National Convention, when the protests over the Vietnam War erupted. And of course, everybody remembers seeing the footage of that. Maybe some people are listening to this show were actually there. So that's in the back of everybody's minds, right? I mean, even though I think most people are saying, at least they're saying right now, that they don't expect something like that to occur, but that's still on people's minds.
Absolutely. Convention officials, city officials, Governor Pritzker and others have really been trying to downplay those parallels, throughout the year during the preparation for this. I mean, it is interesting, even on the political side, there are parallels to 1968, where you had, a president with low approval ratings who decided not to run for another term, albeit Lyndon Johnson made that decision much earlier in the process. And then their vice president stepping in and becoming the nominee. So there are many, many interesting parallels to what happened in 1968. I don't think there's going to be the kind of tension within the convention hall, like you said, like there was back in 68, when you had fights over which delegations from states were going to be seated because of, racial segregation issues among the Southern delegations and things like that. So I think it will be a much more unified message within the United Center. But I think the big wild card, like we've said, is going to be what happens out in the streets. And I don't think you have to look all the way back to 1968 to see why there's concern. Just 4 years ago in 2020, during the George Floyd protests, there were things that got out of hand on the streets of Chicago. So much more recent history to look at and be concerned about in terms of the safety and security around the convention.
Yeah, Charlie, you were not there in 1968. You've mentioned this before. You were in the Peace Corps during that time, but you came back, you began working at the Chicago Sun-Times, less than a year later.
April of 69.
So, I mean, the echoes from that 1968 convention certainly changed things in the city, didn't it?
I think so. I started at the Sun-Times in April of 1969. Some of my fellow reporters had actually been there at the convention and had been beaten up by the cops. And they were very much anti-Daley because of that. And some of them felt, with good reason, that the police kind of sought out reporters and journalists to beat the dickens out of them. And part of it was Daley thought, I believe, Mayor Richard J. Daley thought that he could kind of keep the protest under control. Unfortunately for him, TV network cameras were there recording all this, gave the city a very black eye.
And it helped hand the election to Richard Nixon in some ways as well, maybe not entirely, but,
And the issues in 68, I think, were a lot more critical or a lot more pertinent to people than the issues that we're talking about now. The main driving force behind the protest in 68 was the opposition to the Vietnam War. And there is nothing similar going on today. Now, folks who are of Palestinian ancestry are very concerned about what's happening in the Gaza Strip. But I don't think the general populace has the same concern the way people felt about the Vietnam War 50 years ago. So in that sense, there's not going to be the same kind of tension or the same kind of bitterness within the convention itself as existed in 68. I'm sure many you guys and probably many of the listeners have recall the famous picture of Mayor Richard J. Daley screaming at Abraham Ribicoff and his son, later Mayor Richard M. Daley, echoing, they're shouting up profanities because Ribicoff talked about how what the police were doing to protesters, beating the dickens out of them. As a matter of fact, later on, there was a commission that studied the events and it determined that it was a police riot that occurred. So yeah, I don't think the situation is at all similar this year to what it was back then in terms of the national angst over a war. I don't think there's going to be anything like the kind of brutality that occurred back then in Chicago next week.
Yeah, Dan, I always think when you have these protests, most of them always start out pretty peaceful. I mean, maybe that's the intent in most cases too. But often where things tend to go awry is when they're met with some resistance. So if, you know, police are going to say, hey, this is where you have to stay to do this, and some of the protesters decide, no, we're going beyond that, that's where problems can sometimes come into play. And so I guess that's the flashpoint here, I'm thinking, is that we're looking at to see exactly what is going to happen when any resistance to these protesters is brought in, and hopefully things on both sides stay pretty calm and cool, but you never know.
Yeah, that's right. And I think, you know, the like you said, sort of when the line of protesters meets the wall of police, that's sometimes where things can heat up and go awry. You know, the Chicago Police Department has been assuring us for months that they've been focusing and training on constitutional policing methods and de-escalation, and really trying to keep the temperature low and turn it down when needed. I think, you know, we'll see whether that training has been effective when things happen on the streets. And I think the other element that is a possibility this year that I don't know that it existed in the same way in 1968 is whether you have groups on the right who show up to agitate or cause problems or possibly, you know, provoke some disorder. And that's just that element didn't exist in quite the same way then that it does now, groups like the Proud Boys and things like that. So if, you know, counter protesters show up, there's also the possibility that things could take a turn there. You know, I'm hopeful that things will stay calm, that people will get to express themselves, and that, you know, hopefully we won't have again, shadows of 1968. I think, like Charlie said, while there are parallels, the situations are very different in many ways. And the other thing to note is that the Secret Service, you know, takes over security for events like this, which I think gave us all, you know, a level of assurance, perhaps less so following some of the lapses we saw from the Secret Service during the failed assassination attempt on former President Trump earlier this summer. So a lot going on. It's been a wild summer politically, but I think it's going to be a big moment for Illinois. I think you will see Mayor Brandon Johnson take the stage on Monday to showcase the city. You'll see Governor Pritzker take the stage on Tuesday and various other Illinois figures throughout the week. So, you know, we will be in the spotlight and we'll see how well our elected leaders do in making their case for Illinois and for Chicago.
You're listening to State Week. I'm Sean Crawford, joined by Charlie Wheeler and Dan Petrella with the Chicago Tribune. Well, before we leave the convention discussion, Dan, I wanted to ask about a media perspective on this, and that is we already know Kamala Harris and Tim Walz will be the nominee, the presidential ticket coming out of this. A lot of this is very scripted, so we kind of know what to expect when the convention rolls along. You mentioned Pritzker, you mentioned Brandon Johnson getting some more prime speaking opportunity. But what else, what's the media really looking for, or is maybe your newsroom, what are you guys looking for when you go to cover this?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's some element of unknown still. I think for Pritzker in particular, it's interesting because the nature of his role is sort of the de facto host, but also, you know, his speaking slot had the opportunity to serve as sort of a soft launch onto the national stage for him. But where exactly his future goes from here has been a little muddied by you know, Biden not running for a second term and Kamala Harris becoming the nominee and then being passed over as the choice for the vice presidential nomination. And so I'll be looking to see what he has to say, how he sort of envisions his role within the party going forward. You know, I think we will be really focused, I think, on the Illinois figures and Chicago figures who are involved. But, you know, I think another interesting thing of note is Barack Obama is expected to speak. So it'll be interesting to see what he has to say as this sort of, you know, elder statesman of the party now, 20 years after he gave his speech in Boston that really catapulted him to political stardom. So lots of interesting interesting storylines to watch. Also be watching out for if there are any, you know, future Barack Obamas who take the stage, folks whose names maybe we don't know yet, but who really leave an impression with what they say when they take the stage.
All right. Well, let me move on to some other news that's, of course, happened here. Several things, actually, over the last several days. One of those, Charlie, you are familiar with Stateville Prison, not because you were a resident there, but because you lived in Joliet. It's a nearly 100-year-old prison facility, and by all accounts, it's pretty outdated. And according to many people who represent those who are incarcerated there, that it's actually unsafe. They cite that a man died inside Stateville even earlier this year, according to attorneys, because of excessive heat and poor ventilation. Well, now a federal judge is ordering the state to move prisoners out of Stateville, and that's by the end of next month. Pretty quick turnaround. And he again cited health and safety concerns there. I believe there are more than 500 people housed there, and the majority of those are in the maximum security unit. So I wanted to get your thoughts on this. This is a facility, like you said, I mean, or it's tied to Joliet in that area, but it certainly has outlived its usefulness, and the state is now wanting, of course, to rebuild, build a new version of Stateville, but that'll take some time. So your thoughts about this federal judge decision?
Well, I think it was the correct decision. The conditions are just horrible, and as you say, I don't know firsthand. I've never been incarcerated there or anywhere else, but the problems, and particularly with the heat, this has been a fight that's been going on for more than a decade about the dirty, dangerous conditions at Stateville. Earlier this year, in March, I think it was, the governor announced a plan to rebuild Stateville, along with closing and rebuilding the Logan Correctional Center in Lincoln. That came after a report, a state commission report that was published last fall that said those two prisons, along with the Pontiac Correctional Center, are nearly inoperable. And as a matter of fact, in June, Michael Broadway, who's a 51-year-old inmate, died in Stateville. And the conditions at the time of his death were among the hottest in June. The heat index in Joliet was close to 100 degrees. The cell block where Mr. Broadway was located was on the top floor of his roundhouse, and the temperatures were just so hot. As a matter of fact, at the time when he collapsed and some of his cellmates called for help, a member of the medical team who arrived at the housing unit refused to go upstairs because it was too hot that high up. So in any event, the federal judge has ordered that it be closed because of the health and safety concerns passed by the facility. Now, the union asked me, the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees, that represents the prison workers, is very opposed to this move because of the loss of jobs. And so they're challenging it. But I'm thinking, just for the humanity of it, the people who are there are serving time for offenses they committed, but it should not be under conditions that are medieval torture chambers. So I expect that the plan will be carried out and that the judge's order will be resolved.
Dan, anything you want to add on that?
No, I think Charlie pretty well covered it, other than the fact that, you know, this is another issue that shows, you know, tension, despite the fact that Governor Pritzker is a strong ally of organized labor. It doesn't always mean that the unions that represent the folks who work for him as state employees always sort of march in lockstep with what the administration wants to do.
And of course, Pritzker, Dan, I know you wrote about this back in the spring. The governor likes to tout his record on criminal justice, but also he's had some issues. This has been one that's followed his administration and others as well. But also, for example, the parole board of the state. There were some changes that people wanted to put in place there, and he couldn't come to some agreement on that either, right?
Yeah, that's correct. They were pushing for some more transparency, and there was some disagreement with the Senate over how to do that. And there's been a lot of back and forth between the governor's administration and the Democratic Senate over appointments to the prisoner review board as well. You know, they rejected a couple of his appointees, and the board has sort of almost swung to the right to some extent, to the fact where now some criminal justice reform advocates are saying that they're being too strict in their decisions about when people get released. So it's definitely an issue of vulnerability for him to some extent, although, you know, Republicans tried to use criminal justice heavily to campaign against him in 2022 and did not succeed in that regard.
Well, let me save a couple of minutes here at the end. Charlie, a person who passed away, longtime public servant in the state of Illinois, Bill Holland, he'd retired as the Auditor General, long tenure there as Auditor General. He retired in 2015. He passed away here over the past week, and wanted to just kind of let you talk about Bill Holland for a minute or so.
Yeah, I have known Bill Holland for, my goodness, 50 years or more. And I would say he was one of the finest public servants that I ever encountered during my career at the Sun-Times and then at the university. And he was a very valuable source to me and to many other reporters on issues of state budgets, and then later on just the political operations of the Senate Democrats. He had been the head of the appropriations staff for the House Democrats for a number of years. I first met him when he was an intern in the legislative intern program in the early 70s, and he was the budget director, and then he moved over to become chief of staff for Senate President Phil Rock. And he was someone that you could go to and you'd get a straight answer. But anyway, then he moved over to be Auditor General, and there was some concern at the time whether, because of his partisan background, he could handle that job with the kind of impartiality that was needed. And the first vote to elect him as Auditor General failed. And so there had to be a second vote. And ironically, the person who did most of the influencing to get Senate Republicans to go along with the appointment was Roger Sweet, who was Pate Phillips' counterpart to Bill Holland for Phil Rock. And so he became an excellent Auditor General. He was a pragmatic guy, too. One of the first things that he did, there had been an ongoing dispute between the Auditor General, his predecessor, and the Supreme Court over whether the Auditor General could audit a couple of the agencies affiliated with the court. And so Holland sat down with Chief Justice Ben Miller, who had just assumed that position shortly before Holland did, and they agreed that, okay, Miller says, okay, Bill, you can look at our books. And Bill said, okay, well, we won't argue that we have the legal right to do so. So we kind of set that aside and we'll have this agreement. And so in my mind, that was a very pragmatic, because his predecessor had argued that, yes, legally, I have the right to do it. And the Supreme Court rebelled. So they got that settled. He was He was very helpful for my students also. I would invite Bill in to speak to the students, and he would explain what it was that his agency did. He'd explain his watchdog role. He'd talk about state finances and policy. And he always concluded, and I would always get a kick out of this, he would talk also about what he did not do and what he was not responsible for. And it would be, he says, I'm not the U.S. attorney. I'm not the FBI. I'm not the state's attorney. I'm not the IRS. I'm not the chief executive. I'm not a policymaker. And so he was neutral in all legislation, but he was very good at taking on one of the first things that he did that got him a lot of notoriety was an audit that he did. I believe it was on Central Management Services with Rod Blagojevich. And the audit found that the agency had spent more than $500,000 for questionable expenses. Blagojevich reacted and challenged the audit and was very critical of Holland. But ultimately, the audit results were accepted. And it kind of set the tone that whatever Bill Holland says and whatever his professional auditors conclude, that was gospel. And that was the case all along. So, yeah, as I said it initially, Bill was one of the finest public servants the state of Illinois has ever had. And he will be sorely missed. And as the saying goes, may his memory be a blessing.
Well, let me move on now to our notes from the field. And Dan, we'll go to you first.
My colleague Olivia Olander, who covers state government for us at the Tribune, had a story yesterday about a coalition of banking groups who filed a lawsuit on Thursday challenging a new state law that seeks to eliminate the swipe fees that credit card companies charge on taxes and tips. This is a part of the state budget deal, something that Illinois retail merchants strongly supported in order to get their support for the budget. But the credit card companies are saying this is unworkable and are trying to seek a federal court to block the law from taking effect. Governor Pritzker, in the meantime, has said that the law doesn't take effect till next summer, so there's plenty of time to work out legislatively if there are any issues.
All right. And Charlie?
The governor signed one of the last remaining bills from the spring session, and it added to the State Designations Act an official state mushroom, the Calvatia gigantea, commonly known as the giant puffball. And so now we have an official state mushroom. And the background is that a group of grade school students from Prairie School in DuPage proposed the idea that we should have the state mushroom and it should be this puffball to Senator Seth Lewis, who's a Republican from Bartlett, who sponsored the legislation. And it passed with no significant opposition, in fact, without any opposition at all, I believe. And now it has been signed into law. So congratulations, puffballs. You're now the official state mushroom.
And now we know. That is our time for this episode of State Week. Our panel included Shirley Wheeler and Dan Petrella of the Chicago Tribune. Look for State Week where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Join us next time.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.